The cleanup continues after Hurricane Irma. Boy, aren't we glad to be at the end of the week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. Also, get our podcast on iTunes or through the WJCT app. Just ahead, a special edition of our Friday Roundtable as we take your calls on the aftermath of Irma. Get on the line now and let us know how you're doing. The number to join us, 549-2937. Then later, activist and rabbi Merrill Shapiro sounding the alarm on what he calls a threat to Florida's Constitution. Plus, don't miss it, later in the hour, a live in-studio performance from flamenco guitar virtuoso Goliath Flores and his brand new mariachi band. That's right. And they're in full costume, too. All of that ahead, but first it's Friday and time for the roundtable as we welcome Ron Littlepage of the Florida Times Union. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, Melissa.
David Cotton is here with the Financial News and Daily Record.
Good morning.
Folio Weekly editor Claire Goforth here again.
Good morning.
And A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. And guys, thanks so much for being with us this Friday. I know it's been a tough week for all of you, as it's been for all of just about everybody across the area. Of course, still widespread devastation across the state in the wake of Hurricane Irma as it blew through Florida, leaving virtually no one untouched. Still massive flooding and power outages in our area. Home damage, downed trees, all sorts of headaches and misery. We made it through the storm, though, and we want your calls as we discuss so many facets of Irma's destructive path. The number to join us, and just let us know how you're doing and what your questions are. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Or you can weigh in on our Facebook page. Ron Littlepage, let's begin with you. Just a minute ago, Paul McElroy, the CEO of JEA, gave a live briefing where he tried to bring city officials and the public up to speed on the number of power outages several days after the storm. That's the biggest concern right now for thousands of people.
Definitely, if you're the one that still doesn't have power, it's a big problem. It always is after these storms. Nobody's ever happy with the last one to get their power back.
Of course not. And, you know, JEA's brought in hundreds of crews from other agencies out of state. They will tell you that they're working around the clock, working 16-hour shifts to restore power. Still, though, the utility is on the hot seat over the timetable for restoring everybody. David Cotton, you live in San Marco. Your building saw flooding. Flooding's obviously misery for so many people, along with being in the dark still on this Friday.
Yeah, you know, it would be nice to actually sleep in my own bed sometime in the next 5 to 7 days. But, you know, flooding is one thing, thankfully. You know, most of our building was okay. But, you know, going back to JEA, I think their biggest issue right now is communication. The mayor has, you know, gone out and basically said everything except the CEO's name on record. So JEA is having a communication problem. And, you know, McElroy now getting on the air on the television stations is good, but we would have probably have liked to seen that earlier in the week, too.
They've been providing regular updates, to be fair, but A.G. Gankarski, there is certainly pressure on the utility right now.
Yeah, I mean, the utility's got a perception crisis. Right now, according to their map, they're at 89% complete. 50,000 customers are still out of power. That's actually more people, but 50,000 customers. But, you know, the reality is they said they learned lessons from Matthew. You know, that was the big story last year. The JEA board, all full of Lenny Curry donors and friends, gave JEA's performance high marks after Matthew, but they said they had lessons they learned going forward. So we're 11 months out. It's a few days after a storm. You still have people without power. For some people, that's a humanitarian crisis. For other people, it's an inconvenience. But, you know, when you look at JEA, you see a CEO who makes close to $500,000 a year. You see a C-suite where a lot of people are making over $100,000 a year. You've got a company that wants a $60 million new tower. And keep in mind, that's before the inevitable cost overruns. And they're saying, well, we can't install underground lines because they're too expensive. So you have to question JEA's capital problem. priorities, because, you know, a lot of the power that went out during the storm went out long before tropical storm force winds. You know, it was like a stiff breeze, you know, 30 miles an hour, then you're hearing transformers pop. So, you know, JEA needs to, you know, have a come to Jesus meeting about their capital budget, about their priorities, and they need to consider underground lines in places where power goes out frequently, because you know, even Representative Jay Fant yesterday at Duval delegation meeting said that, you know, they need to look at underground in Riverside Avenue, Ortega. And, you know, this is a House Republican. I mean, this is not, you know, some liberal Democrat saying this stuff. This is somebody who is part of the establishment, relatively speaking. And we need to have those discussions, because the next storm is going to come next year, the year after. And, you know, if we have the situation recur, it's going to be an even harsher conversation.
Just following up on that, you know, Claire Goforth, the other day, Jerry Boyce, the spokeswoman for JEA, was on this program, and she said it's actually a misperception that underground lines fare better during, you know, severe weather.
And that may well be true. It's nice to say, you know, from afar, wouldn't it be great if we had this quick solution that would fix everything? But that solution is probably hundreds of millions of dollars of cost. And we're also living in a coastal city with a very high water table. Nobody in Duval County, with very few exceptions, even has a basement because of our water table. Now, I do agree that, you know, it is necessary to improve our infrastructure, and there are a lot of conversations to be had about that. But another conversation we need to have as a community is our expectation. This was a major hurricane. The entire state of Florida is impacted. That exacerbates JEA's ability to call other crews from other areas to get help here on the ground. I can personally say, as someone who's married to a JEA employee, and don't fire daggers at me, guys, that I have seen my husband for maybe 5 hours since Sunday, and he is not on the ground. He's someone who's going in the command center. We're, you know, working, he's working 16-hour days, and everybody at JEA is doing so. Beyond fixing problems with the website that shows where the outages are, and maybe talking about fixing some of the infrastructural problems, we need to be aware that it's a very hard job, and hurricanes, after they hit, it doesn't just happen overnight. It is a process.
But here's the thing. If you look at Gainesville, Gainesville was right in the track of the storm, the eye of the storm. Gainesville substantially repaired before JEA figured out its messaging strategy. Beaches Energy, they were substantially repaired hours after the storm.
Beaches Energy has less customers, and Gainesville did not experience the kind of flooding that we did.
Both have underground lines, though, and that's the reality. It's like, you know, if you invest in underground delivery systems, you don't need an army of people coming from all over the country to fix these jacked up overhead lines.
Jacksonville is one of the largest cities by landmass.
Ron Littlepage.
It's really you'd phase it out.
It's really easy to, you know, kick the JEA and kick utilities when we're ignoring the bigger problem, is that we have a president and a governor who don't believe in climate change and it allowed a development to overrun the state and fill up wetlands. And that's the bigger problem, folks.
And the number to join us is 549-2937. Let's talk a little bit more about that. We did touch on that earlier in the week with a climatologist at Jacksonville University. And, you know, what climate scientists will say about this is that they'll say it's inaccurate to say that climate change caused Hurricane Irma, but that it is accurate to say that warming oceans are exacerbating already strong storms like Irma, and that over time, sea level rise, along with these stronger storms, are going to create ever more deadly and destructive storm surges in a coastal state like Florida. And as Ron pointed out, David Cotton, the political leadership of Florida, as yet, leaving aside Republican officials in South Florida who are already dealing with the effects of sea level rise, by and large, the political leadership in the state hasn't really come to terms with that scientific reality.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily expect a Rick Scott to overnight change his, you know, philosophical views on climate change. They're not going to upset the base. But I think that is an accurate description. You know, warmer waters, more water is going to create more powerful storms, more storm surge, as we've seen. And it doesn't just mean the beaches or coastal areas.
We saw that this week.
Right?
I mean, look at what happened to the St. Johns River Basin.
Yeah. I mean, I had to kayak to my apartment this week. So, I mean, it's you know. But again, I don't expect the Republican establishment to all of a sudden change their mind because of a hurricane.
Yeah, I talked to Senator Marco Rubio and Senator Bill Nelson. Both agreed that rising water, temperatures are helping to make these storms worse. They diverge on strategies. Rubio talked about mitigation. I asked him about, while he trusted Trump administration to have the scientific wherewithal to handle these storms, he sidestepped that question. Bill Nelson noted that, off of Miami Beach, where they have pumps to deal with flooding from high tides now, they've invested tens of millions of dollars in a pump system. And, pump systems, however expensive they are, may be a solution to some of these issues.
Miami-Dade is on the line regularly to the Netherlands, by the way, because the Dutch, more than anybody on earth, know how to live with rising waters. And they have built this world-class system of pumps and ways to manage standing and flowing water. They, more than anyone, are advising South Floridians on how to deal with this reality. It's scientific innovation trying to adapt to this.
Yeah, and some of the investments that we do or do not make are a reflection of our priorities as a community. We're talking about 100 new cops, which is very expensive, but we're not really talking about, maybe we will be now, underground lines in communities that keep getting hit.
Well, and let me bring this up too, whether it's underground lines, dealing with rising waters, all these challenges we're dealing with. Jacksonville pulled out of the Rockefeller Foundation's 100 Resilient Cities Initiative last year. And they had provided Jacksonville with a $1 million grant to hire a resiliency officer and to begin long-term strategy and planning for dealing with these types of issues. In hindsight, Ron, was that a bad decision?
I think it's definitely a bad decision not to be planning for future problems. There was a lot of politics involved in that particular instance there.
Such as?
The people that put it, the person who was hired to do that job.
Okay. It was the former JFRD official, Jim Moreland, wasn't it?
Yeah. Charles Moreland.
Charles Moreland, pardon me. Yeah.
We have to rethink how we do things in Jacksonville and Florida. I mean, Houston is a perfect example of something that's totally out of control through development. And we're fast approaching that. It doesn't take a scientist to figure out if you cover ground with asphalt, the water's not going to soak into the ground. It's going to run off. And we're doing that every day in this city and state.
Let's talk quickly with all of you out there. Let us know how you're doing this Friday. 549-2937. Joey is in Mandarin. Hey, Joey. How'd you make out?
We actually did pretty well. We lost power for about 15, 16 hours or so, along with many other people out here in Mandarin. I wanted to be, maybe I'll be the only caller to jump in on JEA's side, and I'm not related to anyone who works for JEA, but I honestly thought that they did and are doing a phenomenal job at getting so many people back up and running. I mean, I drove around the day of the hurricane and the day after, and the amount of lines that we saw down and all that, we thought there were some people that were going to be out of power in our area for, many days. And we were calling different people, and they were back up and running fairly quickly. And, in the grand scheme of things, major hurricane comes through, I guess, in my opinion, within the next day, 2 days, it's still very quickly. So, I mean, I'm not trying to discredit people that are still without power, and I know that is very difficult. But just to reiterate what was said earlier, I think they're doing a very good job, and expectations need to be maybe set a little more realistically.
All right. Thanks, Joey. Rod in St. Augustine. Hello, Rod. How are you doing?
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Alyssa. How are you doing?
Okay. Thanks.
I love your show.
Thank you.
My question is, two quick questions. My question is, one, during the hurricane, should we, by the people power out, should we look at a significant decrease for this month in our bill? And also, if they do that, would we look at, they're trying to recruit that money back somewhere else? And that's my question.
Okay. I doubt you'll see a decrease in your bill. Just guessing. AG.
Yeah, you're not going to see a decrease in the bill. And I wanted to address the previous caller's point, because it's important to note. The issue, the complaints that people have with JEA are not with the people in the field. The people in the field are working their butts off. The mayor said so. The issue is, the planning, the organization done in the C-suite. That's a very important distinction. I was on a call with Representative Mayor's Office and City Council on Tuesday. It was not a public call. I was not supposed to be on that call, yet I was on it. What I heard was the
How'd you get on it if it wasn't a public call?
Switchboard glitch. Here's the thing. It's like a representative from mayor's office said that Mayor Curry had already had very stern words to McElroy. I asked Mayor Curry about it on Wednesday. He said, well, that's the thing that happens with teams when they're moving forward. But, you know, council members are wondering why resources are deployed in some areas, not others. Council members also, you know, wondered the district by district restoration timetable. McElroy did not provide that data to the council members. So there's not a lot of transparency even internally in the city, you know, much less with the general public. And, you know, like I said before, you know, Gainesville was up. The beaches were up before JEA figured out its messaging strategy.
Zara on the south side. Go ahead, Zara. Is that your name, Zara?
Good morning. Yeah, Zaria.
Zaria, sorry. Hi, good morning. Go ahead.
That's okay. Hi, good morning. My question is, I live in Mandarin almost 20-some years, and every time when we have hurricane, our division, we have 20 houses on the block, we'll lose power first, and then it'll take forever to come back. We'll be the last one to get power restored. And I was wondering, what is JEA is planning to do about improving our cable to our powers?
Thanks, Saria.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what JEA is planning to do to improve the response time in their neighborhood. If you're having issues with your power and you're repeatedly one of the communities that loses power, you may want to look up and look at all the tree canopy in your neighborhood. We love the tree canopy. I'm a huge fan of it. But the reality is when a storm comes and it knocks down huge limbs, those limbs are what are taking out these lines.
Yeah, I mean, you go drive through some of these older neighborhoods, Mandarin, Riverside, San Marco, and it's literally, there's so many trees down. I mean, the flooding too. I mean, you got to also understand, JEA is not going to be able to turn your power back on if there's 2 feet of water standing there. They got to wait for that water to get out of there. They've got to make sure that, you know, they've got to clean up the trees, the debris, everything that's fallen before they can get there. But yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're dealing with this year in and year out, maybe that's not the best place to live.
549-2937. CJ in St. Nicholas. Hey, CJ, go ahead.
Yes, thanks. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to introduce sort of an idea. You know, we do live in the Sunshine State, and, you know, instead of maybe paying all this capital expenditures on underground lines, is maybe kind of reinventing the grid, making it more decentralized, or maybe a hybrid system, putting more solar, maybe hurricane-proof. You know, solar is getting stronger, the solar panels are getting stronger. To allow for the backup or redundancy for people to have that, because everybody saw that, the day after was the day after the hurricane or the morning of the hurricane, it was pretty cloudy, but between having, you know, later on as the days go on, it's very, very sunny. That's potential for power. And then, you know, introducing things like the Tesla Powerwall, which is like a battery system for storage. And then the other point I'd like to make is a major issue right now that we need to address is that we are planning to dredge the St. John's River. And Melissa, I'm sure you remember you had that expert, the PhD from the University of Florida, who had talked about when we dredge, it's not a matter of if, but it's when we will feel the effects of more storm surge and sea level rise because of the dredging process that it does not protect with the natural processes do not protect once we remove them from this dredging process. I just want to, you know, get the panel's opinion on the dredging and the worsening of flooding and storm surge.
Okay. So thanks, CJ. And 2 points there from him down in St. Nicholas. The first being JEA should be moving more into solar. They have started to move more into solar. But what about that? And Ron Littlepage, you've spoken out for some time now against the dredging project. One argument now in the wake of this flooding is that storm surge would be worse if they dredge. But what about his points?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think it's something that deserves a lot of study because, as I understand, the flooding, especially in Avondale and Riverside and that area, came because the water was pushed up from the south, and that added more water into the normal. I don't. You have to, does it? Does it? Will the dredging make high tides higher? I don't know, but it's certainly something that is worth studying.
Yeah, it does put more water into the river, and yeah. I mean, it just seems logical that if there's more water in the river, then there's more water to flow.
It also makes the water more brackish and more more saltwater intrusion coming farther up the channel is also projected to be damaging.
One thing I've noticed of, and I'm certainly no expert on landscaping, but coming up, driving around downtown, where the water got up, the land, it's already dying. It looks like it's dying, and I think it was because of that extra salinity that they're not used to having.
By the way, here's an email from Diana. I just want to let you know that even with underground electrical lines in our neighborhood, power was out from the storm until last night. Other homes around us with elevated power lines were powered up way ahead. So that sort of buttresses what Jerry Boyce from JEA told us on this program the other day, that underground lines don't necessarily guarantee quicker restoration, at least according to this listener. David Cotton.
Yeah, I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all solution when it comes to energy, especially in a city this size. I mean, as Claire mentioned earlier, this is the largest city landmass in the country outside of, Alaska. But so it is a difficult solution. I think we have several different, areas of town, in where I was evacuated at in, off Kernan and Atlantic, we didn't lose power once at all. But, that's not the case for a lot of people.
Yeah, and when city council people and the mayor try to infiltrate the process, JEA, all their resources are maxed out at the moment. If you expect them to stop and divert significant resources to create a very detailed plan to show where every single neighborhood can expect to be restored, they're only hindering the process of restoration.
Here's an issue with JEA that nobody's mentioning. Their revenues have basically flattened out in recent years, and this is a concern. They're looking for ways to monetize their legacy costs are obviously climbing, more people are going to retire and so on. So, these are the things that, come into play when you have a mature organization that's got legacy cost and that, isn't really planning beyond, moving from one crisis to the next. People can poo-poo, underground lines all they want to, but if you look at the stats in the storm rather than one anecdote or another, in the Atlantic Kernan thing, I'll bet that was underground utility over there, the stats bear out that underground utilities are more reliable. Yeah, there are fixes involved. Yeah, you've got to get power to the underground delivery systems, and that's where a fix comes in, but you've got to look at it really like it is. And it's just, questioning how JEA is handling its business is what we're here to do. We're not here to cheerlead JEA.
Here's an email from Bill in San Marcos. Speaking of JEA's internal structure, it's worth pointing out the JEA board are all the mayor's appointees. He replaced his predecessor's appointees with his own people. So in that sense, does the buck stop with the mayor's office? This is his board.
It was his board last year with Matthew, too.
And I mean, we're in the midst of a crisis. Imagine a situation where JSO was exacerbated like this, and in the middle of it, we're saying, let's divert significant resources so you can give an ongoing play-by-play to all of the politicians who want to return to their constituents and say, look, I'm doing something for you. Maybe the time for that, from a political standpoint, is after.
Let's take
it's
one.
It's always time for accountability.
Let's take one more call. It's Benjamin on the south side. Hi, Benjamin.
Hey, good morning, guys. I was just wondering, how come we don't invest into underground lines? Because in Europe, most of the cities, the major cities, all their power lines are underground, and it looks a lot better, too. I mean, when I drive around Jacksonville, I look around, all these power lines are just hanging, and it's just a mess. I mean, let's say the hurricane is passed now. Why don't we just start off at a neighborhood? Instead of hanging them up, we could put them underground and just keep going from neighborhood to neighborhood and invest into that. And then eventually, I mean, every year we get a hurricane. So I just don't understand why we can't start, somewhere.
Yeah. Thanks, Benjamin, for that. And before we continue on, the four of you, what are your most vivid impressions and takeaways, I guess, from Irma?
A lot of water, a lot of wind, and I'd assume these storms stay away from us, but it's not going to happen.
Yeah, really. I know. Unfortunately, it's not going to happen.
I would say for me, where does this leave the mayor's budget. Where does this, what is, how does this impact his capital improvement program? Because there are projects, there are ongoing projects that, you know, fixes that needed to happen after Matthew that are now still backed up. So I think next week is going to be very interesting down there at City Hall.
Yeah, co-signed on that. I think Dave and I are going to have front row seats to that, and it's worth watching because they've got a budget that's cooked up that was ready to go before the storm. You may see some things in finance committee. You may hear things on the special Monday council meeting that's rescheduled, the one on Tuesday. But I'm looking at the public policy stuff going forward because...
Including requests for FEMA dollars.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Let's talk about FEMA. Yeah. You know, Al Lawson, Marco Rubio, both talked to me about how they're pushing to get FEMA reimbursements from Matthew to Jacksonville, $26 million. Rubio said it can take years. Both of them are trying to, you know, expedite that process. Of course, the question there is, where does the money come from? Does it come from the great printing press? Does it come from China, wherever? But, you know, we'll get the money, we'll spend it, and we'll figure out philosophy later.
I would say the community that you see during a storm and after has been my big takeaway from it. I mean, we have political differences. We have ideological differences. In the end, we're all human. We're all creatures. And when you see people come together, when we've been so divided in this past year and a half, it's heartwarming to see that people reaching out across, you know, across the political spectrum and across the economic spectrum to help one another out.
Co-sign on that. And so I can send you off into your hopefully dry weekend with a smile. Guys, here it is for you right now, only in Florida, the Irma edition. And speaking of JEA, only in Florida do two guys try to steal a JEA light pole that went down in the high winds.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
Did you see this on social media? It was everywhere after JSO posted a photo of two men who were arrested for trying to haul away the JEA utility pole by strapping it atop their SUV. They even tied their shirts to the end of it. Not certain why they nabbed it in the first place.
Sounds just like a Daft Punk video.
Yeah, like what are they? I just want to know what their plan was.
Yes, what was their plan?
Two guys with a thong and a dream.
Let's go.
And finally, only in Florida does a nun grab a chainsaw and start clearing out fallen trees in her neighborhood. This happened down in Miami. Sister Margaret Ann was spotted at work by an off-duty Miami-Dade police officer who posted video of the scene. Now, the phrase chainsaw-wielding nun is one we didn't know we'd ever need to use, but now
only
we are.
Florida.
Only in Florida. Sister Margaret Ann said the chainsaw was in a closet at her school and it needed to get out and be used. She was trying to live up to what she teaches her students, do what you can to help. Have you ever tried to operate a chainsaw while wearing a habit?
I don't remember saws at my Catholic school, but I do remember the nuns being much tougher than the priests.
Oh, yeah, you don't want to mess with them. So, Sister Margaret Ann, we salute you. Thanks so much, Ron Littlepage, David Cotton, Claire Goforth, and A.G. Gankarski. Thanks for being here, guys.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
You
so
too.
Awesome.
And we'll be right back.
Startup incubators have become something of a tired tradition, but this one might be a little bit different.
We want to attract people here that want to create the green revolution, not just come to Hollywood and make the next big movie hit.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the future of clean tech. Startups next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele inviting you to join us this weekend for a Prairie Home Companion from the Fitzgerald Theater with our guests Josh Ritter, John Batiste, and comedian Emma Willman, plus the Royal Academy of Radio Actors, Sarah Jarosz and Aoife O'Donovan, my new song of the week, our salute to musicians' birthdays, and the list goes on and on, all right here this weekend.
Saturday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
as Hurricane Irma moved across the first coast.
The road is covered in debris. We're coming apart out here.
WJCT and the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network, we're here for you.
It is 6:05 a.m. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
The voices you trust on air throughout the storm.
So far in Clay County, there's a really good amount of flooding.
We are joined now by Ryan Bank of member station WJCT. He is in that city's emergency operations center.
With the information you need to keep you and your family safe.
Trying to give you as much information as we can, as quickly as we can look it up.
Jim is along I-95. Hi, Jim. How are things where you are?
Oh, pretty hellish.
The highest winds with Mayport Naval Air Station reporting in with an 87-mile-per-hour wind gust.
WJCT, your community, your world, your news.
Thank you all so much for all your hard work. Believe me, you guys are a lifeline to us.
Welcome back. Well, an investigation is underway after 8 nursing home residents at a center in South Florida died in the chaos of Hurricane Irma. Staff there were scrambling to keep residents hydrated and cool after a tree fell onto a transformer that powered the air conditioning system at the home. The investigation is ongoing. However, nursing home and abuse and neglect is sadly common in this state. Jacksonville attorney Steve Wattrell has represented residents and families in numerous cases of nursing home abuse and neglect, and he joins us now. Steve, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So tragic to see this story out of Hollywood Hills. Not uncommon to see these types of abuses, though, as you know. What were your thoughts when you read of this case?
Well, the first thing I thought about was where was the owner in all of this? Because when you look at the news stories, this particular owner's got a really checkered history, and it's actually not surprising something like this would happen. But, this is a very regulated industry. And when you look at the regulations, nursing homes have to keep a safe temperature anywhere from 71 to 81 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, this facility had a generator, so it's not an issue if the current federal regulations required or not, because there's some controversy about do facilities have to have generators or do they not have to have them. But that's irrelevant because they did have one. And if you think about it, if you were to insert the word children or puppy dogs instead of our elders into the equation, we all know what you would do after 2 days in a facility that's sweltering.
You'd get them to a cool spot.
Yeah. Well, in fact, as we know, there was a hospital right across the street where they were eventually moved. So the question is, what were they thinking allowing these folks to stay in the facility?
And hadn't the hospital reached out many times and said, we're here to help, and the home initially rebuffed the hospital?
I didn't see that, but the story, there is one of the stories that mentions that. But I mean, obviously you can tell when residents are dehydrated and there's no reason not to move them. And it's really part of the regulations for an emergency plan. You have to have a plan to evacuate to other facilities if you can't meet the needs.
Is the through line in all of these cases just a disregard for the elderly? This is a really frail and vulnerable population, and abuse and neglect is much more widespread than people might realize.
Well, it's an issue of resources. We don't commit the resources to our elders. I mean, if you think about it, every time we turn around, they're wanting to cut Medicare, Medicaid, services. And the fact of the matter, very few people can afford private pay. So these people are mostly Medicaid residents after the first 100 days. Long-term residents, Medicare only covers the first 100 days, so you go on Medicaid. But if you keep cutting and you keep not giving resources, this happens. Now, there was an interesting story that actually there was a bill to require generators for air conditioning, I think, in 2005. But of course, our legislators shot it down because they didn't want to spend the money. And that's disgraceful.
So in your view, as someone who specializes in these types of cases, what should the state be doing to better protect its large senior population?
Well, what they need to do is look in the mirror and just face the fact that we have a lot of folks that are going to be retiring, that are going to need nursing home and assisted living facilities, and commit the resources and follow the regulations and have more oversight, because we only have in nursing homes basically yearly surveys, but they're there for 3 days. They don't look at every single regulation, whether they're being followed. It's not until something like this happens that we deal with it.
So it is a well-regulated industry, but facilities don't always live up to the regulations, in other words.
Yeah, and that's really the problem is it's the same with staffing. The biggest problem is staffing, and I know I could guarantee in this case that the most of the staff probably called out because they're out of power, their children are out of school. So you have an understaffed facility with no air conditioning, nobody really to help the residents. This is just completely foreseeable.
We'll continue to follow this trend in Florida. It's just been a tragic element of Hurricane Irma, and we so appreciate your insights this morning. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
He's Jacksonville attorney Steve Wattrell. He's represented residents and families in numerous cases of nursing home abuse and neglect. Back in a moment.
I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, we hunt for beetles in the Kansas prairie.
Those stink beetles, they'll put their butt in the air and stink on you so you won't eat them.
Kind of fruity and unusual.
We'll dissect that scent and get down and dirty with dung and carrion beetles, too. It's all on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
David Lita describes what he finds when he investigates the lives of undocumented Mexicans facing trial in the United States.
There is no poverty in the United States like poverty in Mexico.
And get a Slavic view of the issues facing the member states of the European Union.
Its population is aging fast and actually needs young people, an influx of workforce.
On the next edition of Travel with Rick Steves.
Saturday mornings at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. In 1968, Florida became the only state that allows its state constitution to be regularly changed. It's through a commission called the Constitution Revision Commission. This commission meets every 20 years, and it examines the relevance of the state's constitution to current and future needs. They're going to be meeting again soon, and some activists are sounding the alarm about potential changes to the state constitution. One of them, activist and rabbi Merrill Shapiro. He's immediate past board president with Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Shapiro speaks Monday night at a meeting of the First Coast Free Thought Society and gave us this preview. Merrill Shapiro, welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us.
And thank you for helping to call attention to something important that's going to happen to every Floridian.
You are getting the word out in a talk called Let's Preserve, Protect, and Defend Florida's Constitution. Why does Florida's Constitution need defending?
There is convening and operating, and has been for some time, a Constitutional Revision Commission that's provided for in Florida law to meet once every 20 years to review and update our Florida Constitution. The Constitution in Article 1, Section 3 contains a clause that says no money from the state will go to any religious or sectarian organizations. And it is increasingly certain that the Constitution Revision Commission will attempt to strike that language and place the removal of it on the ballot for November of 2018.
And what are your concerns about that, the long-term ramifications of that?
The long-term ramifications are the government is then going to take your tax dollars and mine and all of your listeners' tax dollars and send it off to religious organizations, some of whom teach things that we do not accept. For example, Florida Baptists will be called upon to pay for the education of the children of Florida's Presbyterians. Presbyterians will be called upon to pay for the education of the children of Seventh-day Adventists. Seventh-day Adventists will be called upon with their tax dollars to pay for the education of Catholic children, and some will pay for Jewish education and Muslim education. We believe Floridians should make their own decisions as to which religious organizations they wish to support. It's a matter of liberty of conscience. I want to decide, and not the government, have the government decide where my dollars go when they go to support religious activities.
And what would you say to those listening who might react by saying, oh, this won't really happen, or this is overstating what might come about changes to the document from this revision commission?
I would say we would rather be safe than sorry. We know those people who say, don't worry about it, and it's really not going to happen. We all too often turn around, and it does happen. And we want to make sure it does not happen. We know that there are forces in the religious right, and I mean the Christian right, the Jewish right, the Muslim right, because I have rabbis who oppose my ideas, and I'm a rabbi, and they believe that state money should go to private schools that teach religious doctrine.
And you said you said you yourself are a rabbi.
I am a rabbi, and I have there are rabbis who oppose me, and they want their schools that they operate to receive funds from the state treasury.
And you just find that un-American.
I absolutely do. Each of us as Americans, each of us as Floridians, has the right to decide ourselves what religious organizations we want to support and which we don't want to support. The government should not be telling us which religious organizations our dollars should go to.
And what are the tea leaves in the legislature you're seeing where you think that this is highly likely to take place?
We see a legislature dominated by concerns religious activities, although, of course, Floridians are almost evenly divided between Republicans and Democrats, and I don't want to get too political here. The legislature is easily in the hands of the Republicans, and they want to curry favor with religious elements that want to, in a way, create a theocracy or put us on the road to theocracy. And this is of great concern. We are not a theocracy. We are a democracy.
It's interesting to note that, as you point out, Florida is the only state in the union that allows for its state constitution to be revisited and changed through this process, this commission meets once every 20 years. Florida stands alone in this way.
Absolutely. And what's most interesting is the recommendations of the commission do not go to the legislature, where our representatives and our voices have a chance to deliberate and debate the issues. It goes directly onto the ballot, where many Floridians are going to make decisions, and many who are not well informed. So our goal with this meeting coming up on Monday of the Free Thought Society at the Buckland Bridge Universalist Unitarian Church at 6:30 is to begin a process of educating the people of our community to understand what the issues are. So when they walk into the voting booth, they can vote intelligently.
And the ballot amendment is not a certainty, but you see it as a probability, correct?
That is correct. Now, 4 or 5 years ago, a tax revision commission met, and they placed on the ballot, it was at the time, I believe, Amendment 8, this very same question. They wanted to strike that language so that the state could support religious schools. And fortunately, it failed. By the way, such an amendment to our Constitution requires a 60% vote, so that makes us feel a little bit more certain. But we are concerned that Floridians don't understand how important this language is in our current Constitution, and actually our Constitution dating back to 1885.
It's sure to be an interesting talk. It's coming up Monday. Monday, September 17th at the Buckman Bridge Unitarian Universalist Church in Jacksonville. Yeah. He's Rabbi Merrill Shapiro, trustee and immediate past president of the National Board of Trustees for Americans United for Separation of Church and State. The talk is titled "Let's Preserve, Protect, and Defend Florida's Constitution." Merrill Shapiro, thanks for being with us.
And thank you so much, Melissa, for bringing not only this topic, but so many important topics to the attention of your listeners and to the good people of our community. You deserve a standing ovation. Thank you.
Just my job. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Finally, this hour, we've had a tough week here in Jacksonville. Don't you think all of us could use some beautiful music right now? I know I could. So we're going to enjoy the talents of the first ever mariachi band in Duval County, as far as we can tell. Mariachi Primera Costa, or First Coast Mariachi, features Philip Pan on violin and vocals, Roger Phillips guitar and vocals, and Goliath Flores, vihuela, and lead vocals. They'll be playing this weekend at the Jaguar exhibit at the Jacksonville Zoo from 10 a.m. to noon, but we've got a live in-studio preview right now. Hello, Mariachi Primera Costa. Hey, guys.
Hello. Hi, how are you doing?
I'm great. You guys are in full mariachi regalia, by the way. You can see the video of their performance at our website later today. So why a mariachi band?
I'm of Mexican descent. I'm Chicano, and it's something that I've always loved. I thought about doing it for a couple of years, and I just never really did it until recently.
And now here you are.
Yeah.
Now, you play the vihuela. That's a five-stringed instrument, typical with mariachi music.
Yes, it's small. It's a small guitar, and it's very loud.
Okay, well, we can't wait to hear it.
Yeah.
You're going to be playing what for us right now?
We're going to be playing La Llorona, which is a traditional Mexican folk song.
Here they are, Mariachi Primera Costa, or First Coast Mariachi.
Todos me dicen el negro llorona negro, pero cariñoso. Todos me dicen el negro llorona negro, pero cariñoso. Yo soy como el chile verde llorona picante, pero sabroso. Yo soy como el chile verde llorona picante, pero sabroso. Ay de mí. Llorona, 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 llévame al río. Ay de mí, llorona, 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 llévame al río. Tápame con tu rebozo, llorona, porque me muero de frío. Tápame con tu rebozo, llorona, porque me muero de frío.
Ay, lo mariachi.
Ay, tanto te quiero, llorona, quieres que te quiera más. Ay, tanto te ha dado, llorona, y quieres que te quede más. No dejaré de quererte, llorona, aunque la vida me cueste. No dejaré de quererte, llorona, aunque la vida me cueste.
It's First Coast Mariachi. Unbelievable. How beautiful. What beautiful music.
Thank you.
You can see them at the Jacksonville Zoo this Saturday. We're going to close with a little music from this area's first mariachi band. 1A is up next. Be sure to listen. I'll be joining the program talking about Hurricane Irma and other top stories of the week. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back Monday. Here they are again, Mariachi Primera Costa.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.